The World is brought to you by Progressive, where customers who save by switching their home and car save nearly $800 on average. Quote at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who save with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Everybody's talking about President Trump's tax records, but there's a lot more at stake than just how voters react.
The mere fact that we do not know the amount of money that the president might owe to foreign governments or foreign interests, that itself is a national security risk.
And in Lebanon, as the economy there falls apart, more and more people are taking the treacherous boat journey to Europe. Ahead, the story of a small boat that sent out a desperate SOS.
We don't have fuel nor water. Someone come please and help us, save us.
Also today, scientists are learning more about the watery secrets of the red planet.
Knowing Mars, we can understand much better past and future of the Earth.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Very glad you could make it today. At last, a little over a month before the next general election, the public is getting a glimpse into President Trump's taxes. The New York Times acquired more than two decades worth of tax records. They paint a picture of a businessman who took extraordinary measures to avoid paying taxes and also incurred huge financial losses. One striking takeaway, Trump paid just $750 in federal income tax in 2016, the year he was elected president. Another finding in the documents, Trump had his hands on a lot of foreign money. Susan Hennessy is the executive director of the blog Lawfare, of the blog Lawfare. She's a co-author of Unmaking the Presidency and was previously an attorney at the National Security Agency. I asked her what she found most striking in the new disclosures.
The fact that the president of the United States owes somewhere between $300 and $400 million in debt that is going to come payable over the next 4 years. That mere fact alone, I think, raises really, really serious questions about who the president owes money to and whether or not those debts, when they finally come due, might ultimately induce or influence the president to do something that is more in his personal financial interest than in the interest of the United States. And I really think the way to think about that is as a national security issue.
Right. It's not just the amount, but to whom this $400 million some odd dollars is owed. Who do we think he owes money to?
Yeah, so we have to be careful in sort of how much we can infer from the reporting about these tax returns. Tax returns are not comprehensive financial disclosures. That said, these documents do strongly suggest that the president owes a significant amount of money to foreign banks, foreign companies, or foreign governments. So we see the amount of money that Donald Trump has paid in taxes to foreign countries. So he's paid more to the Philippines, to Turkey, to India in the first years of his presidency than he actually paid in federal income tax to the United States government. That certainly strongly suggests the degree of entanglement with foreign interests in particular, and also with countries that have quite sensitive business with the United States. I think these documents raise really, really serious questions. They don't provide comprehensive answers, at least not yet, based on what the public has been able to see.
So we know that Trump had been doing business with Georgians, Kazakhs. There are, of course, the golf courses in Scotland. Could those be places where the debt's being held? And why do the documents not show to whom the money is owed?
Yeah, so those certainly could all be sources of where this debt is held. And we would imagine that there's likely multiple sources considering the sheer scope and size. And again, we aren't just concerned about who specifically the president might owe money to, but also whether or not the existence of the debt might offer other avenues in which to influence him. The way we think about this is a foreign government or foreign country being able to provide a thing of value to the president of the United States. The framers of the Constitution actually explicitly forbade that in dual emoluments clauses. And so these really are sort of core national interests of the United States.
So the emoluments clause, as you said, was one check the framers established to avoid foreign entanglements for the occupant of the White House. Why are checks like that not working now?
the framers of the Constitution really knew that they had to guard against this idea of corruption, or else the entire system itself would crumble, and that our system really depends on the legitimacy of public officials who are working for the public good and not for private gain. They talk a lot about the need to separate the love of power and love of money, as Benjamin Franklin puts it. And so in part, they do this by creating structural separation of powers. And in part, they do this through these emoluments clauses. And this is because they really, really don't want the president being bought off or influenced by foreign governments or by individual states. It's also the reason why the framers insist that the president of the United States accept a salary. They want the president to be an employee of the United States, to be deriving his sorts of income only from his job as a public official, because of this really, really fundamental concern of outside interests sort of working to influence the president's thinking, you know, considering the really astonishing amount of power and authority that the American system vests in the American executive.
Susan, what are you waiting to see happens next with this whole situation with tax returns and the indebtedness?
The mere fact that we do not know the amount of money that the president might owe to foreign governments or foreign interests, that itself is a national security risk. That itself is a national security threat to the United States. And so I think the immediate question is, to what extent is the public, the American electorate and American voters, going to decide that this is not a risk that we can continue to take moving forward, and to express that in who they vote for this election?
Speaking of risks, if President Trump wasn't in the Oval Office but still had the sort of debt, taxes, and financial peril reflected in these tax documents, would he pass a security clearance?
I think unquestionably no. So a lot of people have speculated on whether or not these tax returns, or these tax returns in combination with other financial disclosures, reveal some kind of criminal misconduct. We don't know the answer to that. That said, in the security clearance process in the United States, for individuals in the United States who hold these sensitive clearances, access to classified information, the issue of debt, the issue of any kind of financial stress or strain, and very, very specific examination of sources of money is central to that process. And so I find it really, really difficult, if not impossible, to believe that somebody who had the kind of exposure that is shown in these documents could in fact obtain a security clearance. The president of the United States does not obtain a security clearance. He is vested by certificate of election. Mm. That said, these also raise really serious questions about his children, who the president has brought into the White House and has reportedly exerted some political and very unusual influence over the security clearance process in order to grant those security clearances to Ivanka Trump and Jared Kushner over the objection of career officials.
Susan Hennessy is the executive editor of the blog Lawfare. Susan, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
It's about as far to the east of Europe as you can get before you find yourself in Central Asia. And there, an old conflict that is basically about boundaries is flaring up again. Armenia and Azerbaijan are fighting over the disputed region of Nagorno-Karabakh. The violence started on Sunday and continued into today. Dozens of people have been killed by rockets and artillery. Both Armenia and Azerbaijan are pointing fingers, accusing the other of being the aggressor. The mountainous region they're fighting over is internationally recognized as part of Azerbaijan, but it's been controlled by ethnic Armenians going back more than 25 years. The president of the breakaway state, Arayek Haratunyan, spoke earlier today.
I want to declare that not only Azerbaijan, but also Turkey is at war with us.
The Turkish president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, also held his own news conference today and pledged to support the Muslim majority in Azerbaijan.
I condemn once again Armenia, which has attacked Azerbaijan's territory. Turkey will continue to support its friend and brother wholeheartedly and with whatever means are possible.
The U.S., the European Union, and Russia have all called for an end to the violence. In the 1990s, fighting killed thousands of people in this part of the Caucasus. A ceasefire was reached in 1994, but the so-called frozen conflict remains unresolved. A spokesman with the European Commission in Brussels said today, "We hope and we urge everyone to do everything they can in order to prevent an all-out war from breaking out, because this is the last thing the region needs." He added, "There is no military solution to this conflict." Both countries have declared martial law. Azerbaijan's government has moved to block most internet use. As Duri Buscarin now reports, blocking the internet is an increasingly common tactic for governments from the former Soviet bloc.
Most social media is blocked right now in Azerbaijan.
Hello?
But investigative reporter Khadija Ismailova is used to getting around this. From her seat in Baku, the capital, she spent the day working to confirm reports of casualties. This despite a spotty internet connection and a rash of misinformation on social media.
In both sides, I've been looking at pictures of school boy and school girl today who died, like the whole family died in Naftalan.
It's hard to know what the final death toll is. The armies of Armenia and Azerbaijan both tend to overstate casualties on the other side while denying their own. It's likely that dozens have died.
It seems like several soldiers have been killed while sleeping. So like some of the casualties are not attack casualties. They were caught unaware of the situation.
Nagorno-Karabakh is a verdant mountainous region with a bloody history, one that's deeply personal to both Armenians and Azerbaijanis. Before the fall of the Soviet Union, communities of ethnic Armenians and Azeris both lived in the region. It's still internationally recognized as part of Azerbaijan. In the late 80s, Armenians living in Nagorno-Karabakh began a campaign to join neighboring Armenia. This escalated into a years-long war with Azerbaijan that claimed an estimated 30,000 lives and displaced 500,000 people. A ceasefire has been in place since 1994 with intermittent fighting. Nagorno-Karabakh today is a de facto autonomous region controlled by a government with deep ties to Armenia. Today, state-run media show footage of machine guns and tank fire, explosions off in the distance under a blue sky. The internet in Azerbaijan slowed to a crawl early Sunday. Later, the government admitted it had cut access to, quote, prevent Armenian provocations. They say there are floods of Russian-backed accounts spreading misinformation.
Accounts of people in Nagorno-Karabakh being hacked and then communicating that they are, you know, fleeing or that they are... that the battle's not going well and stuff like that.
Lawrence Browers of the London-based Chatham House says disinformation is a constant angle of this conflict.
I think we have seen those kinds of disinformation and misinformation campaigns being used. I think there's also evidence of the use of bots and all of that to increase numbers, the flow of misinformation.
But Richard Girogozhin, who runs the Armenia-based Regional Studies Center, says the social media campaigns he sees appear to be organic.
I do have a fairly well-grounded suspicion of state involvement and state backing in some social media initiatives and efforts. But to be honest, I see this more from Turkey and Azerbaijan than I do from Armenia.
On both sides, he sees a transition to a cyber battle space, where you don't have to be part of the military to engage in a conflict.
And the real target in the social media campaign is to weaken the will of the enemy, if you must. In other words, to try to affect morale and perhaps invoke a degree of panic and distress.
Azerbaijan's military is larger than Armenia's. In this latest attack, it's getting military backing from Turkey, which is increasingly throwing its weight behind regional conflicts in oil-rich nations. But Armenia is diplomatically closer to Russia, and Russia may be the key to another ceasefire, says Ismailova, the journalist. During the last outbreak of violence in 2016, that's how it ended.
In 2016, it stopped. It was stopped by Russian foreign minister's call, because this conflict is a tool of influence that Russia used against Armenia and against Azerbaijan.
In effect, pitting two former Soviet republics against each other. Russia is among those in the international community calling for a ceasefire. But if the Nagorno-Karabakh conflict is resolved, she says, Russia's influence over the region could evaporate. For The World, I'm Duri Buscarin, Istanbul.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Lebanon has fallen on desperate times. The economy has been reeling for months and is in a tailspin. Coronavirus cases are spiking. Politicians can't agree on how to form a new government. And the capital, Beirut, is still dealing with the aftermath of that deadly port explosion early last month. One result, more and more Lebanese are risking their lives to leave the country. From Lebanon, Rebecca Collard has a story of one harrowing boat journey to Europe. And just a warning, there are some details in Rebecca's story that may not be suitable for everyone. Please take care while listening.
Zainab Kak and her husband Nazir Mohammed sold almost everything they owned. Their home, their television, furniture and household goods, even Zainab's jewelry. All to raise the 15 million Lebanese pounds, about $2,000, smugglers wanted to take them to Europe.
This decision because there isn't hope in this country.
A few weeks ago, Nazir Mohammed went down to the beachfront in their northern Lebanese city of Tripoli looking for smugglers.
Everyone knows about it. Like when you walk on the corniche, you can hear people going, like you can see them going. Like even till now, everyone's doing it.
Doing it means trying to escape Lebanon in dinghies and small boats to Cyprus, an EU nation just 100 miles off Lebanon's coast. Until recently, it was mostly Syrian and Palestinian refugees risking the trip. But increasingly, Lebanese people are filling the boats. Lebanon was already suffering its worst financial crisis in decades, with skyrocketing inflation before the pandemic hit. With more and more Lebanese falling below the poverty line, Nazir Mohammed's work as an auto mechanic dried up.
People don't have money anymore to fix their cars. Like the small thing that costs $10 now costs 70,000 Lebanese pounds, so people don't have the money to pay it.
70,000 Lebanese pounds is nearly five times as much as it used to cost. Everything in Lebanon is more expensive these days. Diapers have doubled in price and milk formula has tripled. But as prices shoot up, most salaries stay the same. Instead, what's rising is unemployment. Then came the blast on August 4th that destroyed Beirut's port and for many shattered the last bits of hope they had in their country and any remaining trust they had in their leaders. Zainab Kak says there's no more safety in Lebanon. So on September 7th, the couple and their four children climbed into a boat with dozens of other passengers. It's difficult to know how many Lebanese have attempted this, but the UN's refugee agency says at least 18 boats attempted the trip between August 29th and September 14th. That's more than all of last year. Zainab says the first night was fine and the waves were calm. Her husband, Nazir, pulls up a photo on his phone of that first day on the boat. He's holding his 1.5-year-old son in the air. The sun appears to be just rising and the child's dark curls are blowing in the wind. But by the afternoon, it was clear they were lost. First, the fuel ran out, then food and water. There was no cell phone reception and no way to call for help. They started filling diapers with seawater so they could wet their mouths under the beating sun. Zainab could see that their son's small body couldn't take it, but there was nothing she could do. After he died on the boat, she held his body for 3 days. Eventually, she says, the others convinced her to let him go. They wrapped his body in blue jeans and let him into the water. When another man died, Nazir says they pushed the body overboard and attached a note with a plea for help.
We have dead kids and we're lost. We don't have fuel nor water. Someone come please and help us, save us.
Also on board that boat was 24-year-old Mohammed Hosni. When people on the boat began dying, Mohammed jumped in the water and swam off to find help. His brother Ali Hosni tells me that none of the other six siblings in Lebanon have jobs, but they all pitched in to raise $650 to get their brother a seat on the boat.
That was the plan. Everyone that went there, that was their plan, to find a good job and start sending money to the people here.
Hey, yeah,
But instead, friends and family of Mohammed Hosni gathered in the streets last week as his body was brought back to Tripoli after being pulled from the water near Beirut. The next day, his brother Ali Hosni held what he calls a wedding, not a funeral. Long tables were put in the center of their street in Tripoli. People gathered around on plastic chairs.
My brother wanted to leave Lebanon for a better place. He wanted a place that would accept him. God gave him that. Now he's in heaven.
Mohammed Hosni never found help, but after 8 days at sea, the other passengers on the boat to Cyprus were finally rescued. A Turkish ship brought them back to Beirut. Zeynep Kak, who had lost her son, refused to get off the boat. I didn't want to come back to Lebanon. I kept hanging onto the rails of the Turkish ship, she says. Now she and her husband are back in Lebanon with even less than they had before. No house, no furniture, and without their youngest child. I asked Zeynep who she blames for the death of her son and what happened to them. The Lebanese government, they are the ones that made us do this, she says. The smugglers just needed money. They are poor too. Zeynep says her family remains desperate to leave Lebanon, and despite everything that happened, they would take the risk again and get on another boat to Europe. For The World, I'm Rebecca Collard in Tripoli, Lebanon.
If you want to stay on top of what we're working on here at The World, you can know about it before you hear about it on the show. Start off your morning with a quick hit of news stories from around the globe. Our newsletter is Top of the World. Subscribe for free at theworld.org/newsletters and start the day informed. Life on Mars, in Portuguese. In any language, the prospect of life on the red planet is a wild thought.
It will be great to find traces of life, but that will be, again, quite challenging.
Coming up later on The World, a Mars researcher tells us about the discovery of a network of saltwater lakes beneath the Martian surface and whether they can support life. Brazil's Seu Jorge covering David Bowie there. We'll be right back with more in the next half hour of the program. You're listening to The World. China is building big in Cambodia. That includes a whole new port.
When China builds a port for you, you can trade.
But increasing trade might not be China's only motivation. Chinese infrastructure projects can also be used for military purposes. China's influential Silk Road runs through Cambodia. That's coming up next here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. It's nice when a neighbor helps you out. Southeast Asian nations are getting a big boost from China. Across the region, Chinese state-run companies are investing in lots of infrastructure projects, ports, train lines, and real estate. Consider Cambodia. Chinese investment there has helped create tens of thousands of jobs and strengthen Cambodia's economy. But opening the door to investment from China also comes with risks. Our next story comes from our weekly collaboration with veteran China journalist Mary Kay Magstad and her podcast On China's New Silk Road, reported in partnership with the Global Reporting Center. Here's Mary Kay.
Cambodia's port city of Sihanoukville used to be a charming, laid-back beach town with ochre-colored French colonial architecture. Now it looks like a modern Chinese city with construction cranes, endless traffic jams, signs in good Chinese and bad Khmer, and so much concrete laid down over ground that used to absorb monsoon rains that the floods are really something. I I step over sandbags and into an aid agency that works with poor urban families and kids. On this particular day, some of the classrooms on the ground floor are flooded up to our ankles. This group, Malap Tapang, helps educate thousands of poorer Cambodian kids in Sihanoukville, and it provides health care and other services for their families. It's been a headache for such families, dealing with Sihanoukville as Chinese boomtown starting in about 2016. Prices soared, landlords kicked out Cambodians so they could charge Chinese tenants five times more. Malap Tapang's medical program director, Nojan Ravi, compares the surge of Chinese into Sihanoukville to this flood.
We don't really hear something about that before they come. Oh, a really, really big population of Chinese people will come into our city and will develop our city. And when they come, it's kind of like the flood that we are having. It's just kind of like the water has come really, really fast.
Sihanoukville was already Cambodia's only deep water port. Chinese investment built an industrial park here, which created some 10,000 Cambodian jobs, and Chinese construction is expanding the city. But some things happened in Sihanoukville that were outside the plan, thanks to Cambodia's lax legal system. Dozens of casinos opened, and Sihanoukville became a center for money laundering and even for Chinese gang activity. There was other violence, too. I hear about it from two journalists I'm traveling with here, Jan Siniat, who's Cambodian, and Andy Nachimson, who's American. They've worked together, and among the stories they've covered were land grabs here in Sihanoukville, so land could be sold to Chinese buyers.
We just passed an area called Prai Nab, where some of the more violent land disputes have been going on. So as Chinese investment has come in, land prices have risen exponentially, and it's resulted in a lot of arguing over who owns land. And in Prai Nab in particular, there's been villagers fighting back violently, and there's been police using force, and somebody even got shot, and he survived, but police have used live rounds to counter these protests.
Even the resident who live here for many years, but it's never guaranteed for sure that they can stay here for the next generation, because the Chinese come in and the authority kind of, okay, we make the deal with Chinese and we force you out.
Cambodia's government has welcomed Chinese investment. And in the midst of the COVID pandemic in China, President Xi Jinping welcomed Cambodia's Prime Minister Hun Sen. President Xi said how much he appreciated Hun Sen's visit in the midst of this crisis. He said this showed that China and Cambodia are all-weather friends. China and Cambodia do go way back, and in a way, Hun Sen and China do too. Hun Sen was a teenage Khmer Rouge when China backed the group in its fight to take power during the Vietnam War. When the Khmer Rouge won, Hun Sen became a local official, and China kept backing the Khmer Rouge as they turned Cambodia into a giant work camp and caused almost 2 million Cambodian deaths. It ended finally with a Vietnamese invasion. Hun Sen by then had switched sides. He was installed as foreign minister, then prime minister. And China spent the next dozen years backing the Khmer Rouge as they fought to overthrow Hun Sen's government. But those are bygones now. At that meeting in Beijing, Hun Sen told President Xi people were making too much of COVID-19.
We are called now by some kind.
He said the Cambodian students who were in Wuhan, where there was an active outbreak at the time, they'd be just fine staying there. This was a performance of loyalty by China's most reliable friend in Southeast Asia. Hun Sen has even blocked a resolution by the Association of Southeast Asian Nations that condemned Chinese aggression in the South China Sea. What Hun Sen gets out of this is a patron who keeps aid and investment coming and hasn't voiced concern that some of his critics have been shot dead, or that he's banned Cambodia's main opposition party, or that he's said to be grooming his son to succeed him.
So the less developed country, the more acceptance you are to China influence.
Sok Ka is a Cambodian economist.
And the less developed country, the little bit more authoritarian government, then the more likely you are alienated from the Western world. So the more closer you are trying to get yourself with China, right?
We're chatting in a Phnom Penh coffee shop about a report he wrote for the Asian Development Bank about China's Belt and Road investments in Cambodia. And he's pretty clear-eyed about China's general strategy here.
In China's eye, Cambodia is nothing other than this tiny spot of land who is ideally located in this region, whereby surrounded countries are partly or wholly influenced by other contesting powers. So in order to put my footprints in here, then I need some friends.
I'm Mary Kay Magstad, and you're listening to On China's New Silk Road, a production of the Global Reporting Center, and a special feature today on the world. China's strategists are still focused on the long game all along Cambodia's coast. In July 2019, the Wall Street Journal broke the story that Cambodia and China had signed a secret 30-year deal that allows China to use Cambodia's naval base, Ream, to base warships, personnel, and weapons. Hun Sen at first decried this as fake news. A year later, he said, "It's not an exclusive deal. Any foreign navy can dock at our base." Ream is just an hour's drive south of Sihanoukville, through a national forest with a fair bit of construction going on within it. On our drive there, Saniyat says she'd wanted to go when the government put on a press tour to rebut the Wall Street Journal report, but she wasn't invited.
I think they are trying somehow to let the local journalists to spread the news that nothing's happening there. The rumor of the Chinese military base is not true. And also, one of the government spokesmen said they don't trust the foreign journalists, so that's why they only bring the local journalists. And the local journalists, they are also selected.
But it's kind of a classic diversionary tactic by the Cambodian government, which probably does have some success in terms of local consumption, that they can accuse the West in the U.S. and the Wall Street Journal of spreading fake news, and through their pro-government media outlets probably convince some local people that this was all a plot by the U.S. and the Wall Street Journal.
A plot by the U.S. to do what?
A plot by the U.S. to destabilize Cambodia. They seem to believe that the U.S. wants to kind of reinstigate a Cold War-type conflict.
There's certainly a competition between superpowers here. A few years ago, Cambodia stopped doing military exercises with the United States and started doing them with China. We get to Ream and take a spin around town. It's a quiet village, really, other than the military installations.
They've taken kind of a chunk out of one of the hills to use the rocks and gravel.
They would definitely need to improve the roads, though.
I'm guessing that's going to be high on their priority list.
Down one muddy road, there are Chinese construction teams working on what's billed as holiday housing. It looks like it could serve other purposes, too. Down at the beach, we can look across to where a few small Cambodian Navy patrol ships are berthed. It's all pretty quiet on this particular day. A local shop and restaurant owner on the beach, Mao Sok Ka, tells us she hasn't seen Chinese military here yet, but she's heard they might come.
It's so scary. It's like if there are foreign militaries, what happened if they took away our land, our country?
Because Cambodia has already had foreign militaries in the country, right? The French, when they were the colonial power, the Americans bombed Cambodia, the Vietnamese came in and invaded.
When I was young, we hiding underneath of the ground to escape from the U.S. military's bombs in Cambodia. And again, it's this war and that war, and we have a lot of war, so I feel like we had enough.
but being here would be useful for China. Ryum is near the Vietnamese border and the South China Sea, both places China wants to keep an eye on. In fact, leaked documents reported by ABC Australia detail planning that was done by China's defense attaché in Cambodia for a visit to Ryum in early 2020 by a high-level Chinese military mapping and surveillance team. 3 weeks later, a Chinese military-style drone was found crashed about 50 miles up the coast, past Sihanoukville, in one of Cambodia's least populated provinces, Koh Kong. And what's happening there is another fascinating part of China's strategy in this region. The Darasakor Resort in Koh Kong is a sprawling place. But over the couple of days we're there, we see just a few visitors, almost all of them Chinese. The beach is all but empty. Even the casino across the parking lot has few people at the tables. The rooms in the hotel itself are pretty basic. I've seen nicer dorm rooms, which is a little weird in a place billed as a luxury hotel. But the road outside is wide and freshly paved, with streetlights and landscaping that feel like part of a gated community in a national park, where there's been a lot of illegal logging. As we drive around, we see a Chinese-built hydropower dam and reservoir, and Chinese construction teams building dozens of high-rise buildings. Full-color billboards trumpet what is yet to come. One is for a place called Temitown. Andy looks it up on his phone. The signal is good here, even though this is a pretty remote part of Cambodia.
That will include, it's a five-star hotel with 800 rooms, a commercial center, a golf course, bungalows, villas, amusement parks, and a naval park, whatever that means.
So here's the deal with this whole area. About a decade ago, the Cambodian government gave a Chinese company with strong Communist Party connections a 99-year lease for 20% of Cambodia's coastline. The lease includes this huge area. It's about 2.5 times the size of Washington, D.C. And this is much bigger than any single concession is allowed to be under Cambodian law. The rent is $1 million a year, with the first 10 years free. Not a great deal for Cambodians, but it seems to have been something Hun Sen's patrons in China wanted, because shepherding the deal through was Zheng Gaoli, one of the 7 most senior leaders in China at the time and chair of the Chinese government's leading group on the Belt and Road Initiative. And yet, the Chinese company in charge of this project, the Union Development Group, says it's just trying to develop Cambodian tourism, which is why, it says, it's building an airport.
I'm standing in the middle of what appears to be the beginning of the biggest, longest runway in Cambodia. This runway is longer than most commercial flights need to take off and land.
Andy is skeptical. He's been reporting on this development in Koh Kong for a while.
Unless there's going to be millions of tourists flying into Koh Kong, like, it's absolutely unnecessary to have an airstrip that big. They do claim that the plan is to have millions of tourists coming through that airport, but I mean, from what we've seen so far, that doesn't seem realistic, at least not for a long time. And then something else that some security experts told me was that the airstrip has certain characteristics in terms of the way it's being built that are similar to Chinese military airstrips.
Some such analysts say the entire Chinese concession in Koh Kong looks like it could easily be converted to military use. A Cambodian government spokesman has dismissed that kind of speculation, saying any place can be converted to military use. But not every place has its own hydropower station or a runway long enough for fighter jets or plans to build Cambodia's second deepwater port and housing for tens of thousands of people. Not every holiday enclave is near the South China Sea, across not only from the Malacca Strait, but also from a narrow stretch of southern Thailand, where Thais are considering building their own version of the Panama Canal. This set of factors caught the interest of the U.S. government. On September 15, 2020, it sanctioned the Union Development Group, the company that has this concession. And the U.S. used Magnitsky authority, the one meant to punish gross violations of human rights. The Treasury Department statement said this concession is a malign Chinese investment that has forced Cambodians from their land and devastated the environment. And, it said, if this area were converted to military use, it could threaten regional stability, freedom of navigation, and overflight. The Magnitsky sanctions block all of the Union Development Group's holdings and property in the United States or in the possession or control of U.S. persons. Why this action now? Mounting concern about Chinese positioning along Cambodia's coastline? And then there's also the strategic advantage China could gain if it builds and manages that Thai version of the Panama Canal. But now, with the U.S.-China trade war and the region's economies hit by a pandemic, Southeast Asian countries don't want to be forced to choose between China and the United States. Southeast Asians want to shape and control their own future. They want options and respect and reliable partners. And in that, many say, the United States still has a vital role to play if it would just do it.
Mary Kay Magstad reports on China's global ambition in the podcast series On China's New Silk Road. Next week, we'll hear about how Beijing is extending its reach into Central America. Universities around the world are undergoing their own reckonings regarding racism and elitism on campus. A new documentary explores life at Cambridge University in the UK. The film, titled Somali Nemo, follows four British Somali students as they navigate the prestigious halls as black Muslim women.
I knew it was going to be academically challenging, but I couldn't prepare for, and I hadn't prepared for, all the other challenging aspects of it.
That's Awa Farah, the film's writer, producer, and cast member. Awa joins us from Cambridge. Thanks for being with us, Awa. Your story is one of four told in this documentary. There is something you said in it about going from London and blending in on the streets there to being highly visible at Cambridge. Can you talk about that? Explain the differences.
Yes. So all four of the girls in the documentary, including myself, we all came from London. And I think London is often known to be a, you know, highly multicultural space in which you just sort of blend in this really sort of beautiful way. And I think coming to Cambridge, something that came up constantly in the interviews was just this shift that happened when we arrived at Cambridge, where we started to feel more visible just because there was less people who looked like us.
What year are you now at Cambridge? And specifically, what about life at Cambridge surprised you the most when you arrived there?
Currently, I am starting my PhD. So at the time that we were filming the documentary, I was doing my master's. And I think the thing that probably surprised me the most at Cambridge is just how it can feel so far from home.
Mm. Let's talk about the word home. Part of the documentary takes place in a room that the four women kind of describe as a classic Somali home. You're all together sitting comfortably on the sofa and having a conversation about your experiences of life in two worlds, the differences between your lives and your parents' lives. Here's another moment from the documentary where you're speaking, Awa.
In many ways, I was really envious of my mom's and my dad's life in Somalia because I realized that I would never have a sense of home like that. Like you're born into a country, and that's all you know, the people all you know. And I'm so sorry, guys. Like, I don't know why I'm getting emotional. That's really weird. I just need a second.
Mm. What were you feeling there, Awa? What made you get emotional?
You know, growing up as someone from the diaspora, you feel a sort of disconnect between what your parents know as home and what you know as home. And I think that was sort of the first time I was actually trying to articulate into words just how I felt about not really ever having a sense of home the way my parents had a sense of home. And I think in many ways I was very envious growing up of sort of like these stories my parents had and just like the ease in which they fitted into this country and they didn't have to ask questions about the identity.
Since filming began on Somali Nemo a couple of years ago, the Black Lives Matter movement has grown into a global movement. How does your doc Somali Nemo resonate with this movement?
I think it's just a case of, you know, looking at the way in which these institutions, because they are ultimately deemed to be sort of like elitist, white, mainly traditional institutions, and just making them a place in which where students feel that they can apply because this could be somewhere they can be.
Hmm. Finally, what does Somali Nemo mean?
So Somali Nemo basically means Somali-ness, so like the essence of being Somali. The meaning of that, it's different for everyone, but ultimately it sort of refers to the way in which, like, no matter where we are in the world, our Somaliness, like our culture, is always there at the heart of it. And ultimately, we always call Somali Nemo a love letter and a celebration of Somali culture. Mm. And I think that's sort of what that name defines.
Awa Farah is the producer and writer of a new documentary called Somali Nemo. You can watch the film for free on The Guardian's YouTube page. Thank you so much for speaking with me today, Awa. Congratulations on this documentary.
Thank you very much.
Let's leave the world and take a quick trip to Mars. 2 years ago, scientists were shocked to find a large watery lake beneath the red planet's icy south pole. Now scientists are getting a clearer picture of what that's all about. They've discovered not just a single lake, but a network of salty water bodies just under the surface of the planet. Joining me from Rome, Italy, is Mars researcher Elena Pettinelli. You were part of the team that discovered water on Mars in 2018. What are the new things you've learned about the water under the South Pole of that planet?
This time we analyzed a larger area with respect to the previous research. We collected much more data. We discovered that it's not just a single body of water, but there are also other three small body of waters around the main one.
So when it comes to looking for life on other planets, NASA's mantra is follow the water. It's all about water. Why is finding water so momentous in the search for life on Mars?
Well, we have to say the way we know life, of course, water is one of the main places where the life can develop.
Right. So what would be the next step? Is it possible to go in remotely somehow and see if there's life in these lakes?
Unfortunately, I don't think so. It's very difficult. It's technical, very challenging to go on the pole and make a drill that is as long as 1.5 kilometers. So it would be challenging on Earth. So it's at the moment, I think, is really difficult. Would be nice to at least go there and try to sample the ice and see what we can find in it.
So sampling the ice is possible. What could you learn from sampling the ice?
Well, you might find some trace or some evidence of some specific chemicals, compounds, or things like that. Of course, it will be great to find traces of life, but that will be, again, quite challenging.
And when you say finding traces of life, I mean, what kind of life might there be in this water on Mars?
Kind of a colony of bacteria, or really simple level of life. You can find complex molecules that make you think that there was a development of life, or you can actually find bacteria, and bacteria can really live in very difficult environments.
So why do you research Mars? Why do you think it's important to get to know our red planet neighbor better?
Knowing Mars, we can understand much better past and future of the Earth. For example, the climate change that happened to Mars might tell us something about some aspects or some possible path that we could have in the future with the climate change. And also looking at Mars, probably we'll understand much better what happened in the past on Earth. So I think it's important to look outside of us to learn about us and also to learn about the evolution of the solar system.
Elena Pettinelli, a researcher at Roma Tre University in Rome, Italy. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
That'll do it for us today, right here on Terra Firma. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. Thanks for listening today. We'll be back with you tomorrow. From PRX.